we look at the Killeshandra 12th of 1921, one of their main speakers, William Martin, gives kind of a sense of the flux and the uncertainty that existed in Cavan and Monaghan, in the three counties at this time, when he stands up and he says, "We are not fully now either north or south. We are rather in a state of suspended animation. We are neither the one thing or the other." And I think that's a kind of a good description both of Protestant loyalist unionist experience in these counties at that time, and also of those counties themselves. The three counties of Cavan, Monaghan and Donegal were anomalies in the Ireland of the revolutionary period. Demographically speaking, they were far less Protestant than their Ulster neighbours, electorally less unionist, but also far more so these things than any non-Ulster county, except perhaps Dublin. Even in the least Protestant northern county of Fermanagh, the non-Catholic proportion of its population was nearly twice that of Monaghan and nearly thrice that of Cavan. In absolute terms, Antrim had over 10 times the Protestant population of Monaghan. However, this community, despite their overwhelming minority, in many ways more similar to a southern unionism, still buy into the idea of Ulster, of belonging to the northern of the two Protestant loyalist communities in the country. They actively engaged in an opposition to Irish nationalism that fell along broader religio-ethnic lines, conforming with and named for the ancient territorial unit of Ulster. To them, their Ulsterness isn't something to be questioned. It is a casual assumption, not something they need to defend, just something they carry with them. As a counterexample to this, you can see, for example, if you look in Fermanagh, the unionist defence of their entitlement to join the northern, to join the six counties, as it were, they're much more insecure about it, and there's much more public debate about it and defences of it and articles written on one side or the other, whereas this isn't something which happens in Cavan and Monaghan. It's an accepted casual fact that the loyalists and Protestants of Cavan and Monaghan are Ulstermen, at least to them. In this context, Cavan and Monaghan are a useful case study as they represent a nominally Ulster Protestant movement existing on the fringes of its homeland and outside of the numerical majority that its adherents enjoyed elsewhere. For Cavan and Monaghan, Ulsterism was more difficult than elsewhere in the province, where the Ulster counties have the luxury of being surrounded by Ulster other counties. Cavan and Monaghan, much more than Donegal, form a boundary with areas definitively not of Ulster. At the same 12th in Killeshandra, the same speaker, Reverend Martin, asserted a broader border identity than the one usually associated with Ulster. He says, "I see here Leitrim men and Ulster men, and I do not know whether I am a Leitrim man or a Cavan man, as I live on the border, but I believe I am half the Connacht man and half an Ulsterman." It seems that in many cases, it was the act of happening to live within Ulster and then of choosing Ulster Protestant as an identity that distinguishes Cavan Protestants particularly, but also Monaghan Protestants from their non-Ulster neighbours. So in this paper then, we will attempt to trace some of the ways in which the Protestant and Loyalist community in Cavan and Monaghan engaged with this concept of Ulster, and then examine this Ulsterism in the context of the single greatest crisis it faces, which is partition, and from their view, abandonment. An important question then we must ask ourselves here is how we trace this Ulster identity, how we measure it. For the purpose of this paper, as opposed to, you know, as any sort of definitive statement on the way to measure Ulsterism, we will engage with four of the most obvious: signatories of the Covenant, membership of Unionist clubs, membership of the Ulster Volunteers, and recruitment into the British Army during the First World War. The Ulster Covenant, with its accompanying declaration, are perhaps the most obvious single statements of an Ulster identity, limited as they were to those who had either lived in Ulster or were born in Ulster. The Covenant itself was an oath binding its signatories to oppose any attempt to coerce Ulster into home rule. Its limited length and vague phrasing would cause some problems later on for unionists in Cavan, Monaghan and Donegal. We should be careful, of course, with assigning any particular depth of fervour to the signatory of the Covenant simply because they signed it, especially in regard to Cavan, where the RIC district inspector noted that in the majority of cases, this Covenant is signed more as a passive statement of preference than it is a commitment to militarily resist, which it can be interpreted as elsewhere. However, at its most basic level, it represented a statement of uncomplicated identity. To sign the Covenant was to declare yourself of Ulster. David Fitzpatrick has already tabulated the contribution of the three counties to the Covenant, noting that 4,423 men and 3,722 women signed the Covenant and Declaration in Cavan, and 5,397 men and 5,082 women did so in Monaghan. Expressed as a percentage of the adult non-Catholic population, 71% of eligible Cavan men and 65% of Cavan women signed the Covenant. For Monaghan, these figures are 83% and 80%. So not only does this show a significant jump between Cavan and Monaghan in terms of commitment to the Covenant, but it also puts Monaghan up there with some of the most subscribed counties in the province, alongside Armagh and Tyrone, whereas Cavan itself is dead at the bottom of the table. In the declaration, its women are underperformed by Belfast women. However, while Cavan is undeserved as a signatory of the Covenant, or is underserved as a signatory of the Covenant, it does much better in other areas. In particular, it experienced an upsurge in interest in the Unionist clubs at the time of the Home Rule crisis. In November 1912, Cavan had 12 Unionist clubs in the country, with 1,425 members, or 23% of the adult male population. By May 1913, this had become 16 clubs, with 1,949 members. So this represented an increase of just over 500 members in just 6 months, which is around 3% of the non-Catholic population. This is compared to an average increase in Ulster of about 0.5%. As a proportion of the active male non-Catholic population, that comes to about 8%. Monaghan's increase came to 466 new members in the same period, representing 0.7% of the total non-Catholic population, which is a figure still above average, which is a notable 7% of the active male population. I will apologise here now for kind of almost figure bombing. I'm going through it last night. I realised I should have included a PowerPoint to put all these up there, so mea culpa for that. The total percentage of the active male population engaged in these Unionist clubs comes to 23% for Cavan and just over 20% for Monaghan, both of which compare very favourably across Ulster. Cavan's figure in particular is the second highest in the country, behind only Tyrone, while Monaghan is roughly commensurate with Armagh. Membership of the UVF in these counties was equally strong when compared to the rest of the province. In May 1914, 55% of Cavan's adult male non-Catholic population was a member of the organisation, which was a number far in excess of those joining in any other county. Monaghan too saw 33.6% of its active male Protestants join, which was in excess of the percentage who joined in definitively Ulster counties such as Down or Antrim, and roughly the same as those joining in Fermanagh. We should also highlight that in spite of Monaghan's larger Protestant population, the Cavan UVF boasts a membership of 3,500, while Monaghan itself could only muster around 2,100. Despite these high figures, Cavan and Monaghan's peripherality can be reflected in its low levels of arms held for the UVF. In November 1913, the Monaghan UVF's 1,650 members had to share 385 arms between them, so roughly one gun for every four volunteers. Cavan fared better here and got 1,700 weapons to share between 3,000 of them, so every volunteer got just over half a rifle. By March 1914, this had improved to where Cavan now boasted over 2,500 arms, so including a quarter of all Martini Enfield rifles held in Ulster. Overall, it held roughly 10% of all the arms held in Ulster in the period just before the Larne gunrunning. This is in a county that held just 2% of all the Protestants in Ulster. Monaghan, meanwhile, only increased its cash to 561, which is roughly a fifth of what was held by Cavan. So when taken by these metrics, we can at least say that Cavan and Monaghan Protestants engage at more or less equivalent levels as other undeniably Ulster counties. We can say that for some of this, their role as kind of being on the border and being most at risk of falling into the South required more of a kind of an identity reinforcement and required active engagement in these organisations. However, this high participation is not carried through when we engage the topic of World War I recruiting. War recruiting was another area in which Ulster Unionists had distinguished themselves from the rest of the country, the rate of recruitment in Ulster roughly matching that in Britain and far ahead of recruitment in any other Irish province. However, neither Cavan nor Monaghan are particularly heavy contributors to this drive. An Armagh meeting addressed by Lord Farnham in September 1914 was recorded as having a pitifully small attendance and only accruing 3 volunteers from the entire district. Cavan numbers were seen as disappointing, especially on the Unionist end. 1915 saw only 453 recruits in the county for the entire period. Monaghan fared just as poorly. As early as December 1914, the county inspector noted that there was nobody coming forward. a Rakari assembly in January 1915, despite attracting 140 members of the UVF, failed to yield a single recruit. By October 1916, only 738 recruits had come forward of an estimated eligible population of 2,234. However, despite these disappointing figures, when we look more at the ratio of Protestant recruits to Protestant males with non-agricultural occupations, taken for, as a gap, say, between the 15th of December 1914 and the 15th of December 1915, again, figures I'm grateful to David Fitzpatrick for providing, Cavan demonstrates an extremely high ratio of 105 recruits per 1,000. This is the second highest ratio in Ulster, only behind Antrim and Belfast, who have 110 per 1,000. Nationally, it ties with Longford and falls short of Carlow, which is its own strange anomaly, although both of these, again, are counties with substantially smaller Protestant populations. The ratio for Monaghan was much lower at 65 per 1,000, and this echoes quite closely the disparity in UVF membership. However, despite this low participation in the war itself, the concept of the war as Ulster's war and the battles of it winning her undying glory were as prevalent in Cavan and Monaghan as elsewhere. At the general celebration of the 12th in Monaghan in 1918, the following resolution was proposed and unanimously accepted, thereby affirming our admiration for the gallant Irishmen who are now fighting our country's battles at the front, our sympathy with those who have now been wounded, and our undying respect for the memory of the noble fellows who have fallen in the fight for freedom, especially those from Ulster. The Cavan Unionist paper, the Irish Post and Weekly Telegraph, took the step of abandoning advertisements on their front page for the entirety of the war, sporting instead photographs of, you know, war developments, the digging of trenches, and in particular, those who fell in the war. The focus on the war glory of Ulster was an inherently exclusivist position, as it relied on downplaying the rest of Ireland as a separate and inferior entity, and any reference to the war and of the great contribution of Ulster to the war, A, will be accompanied by a line saying how this is completely different from the South and how Southern Unionists especially are letting the side down, and B, will be devoid of any reference to Cavan and Monaghan's own recruiting record. If Cavan and Monaghan could not point to their losses in the war as the best example of their sacrifices, they did, however, hold another example of their commitment to the cause of Ulster, their willingness to accept partition in wartime to aid the war effort. Specifically, they look back on the unanimous decision of the Ulster Unionist Council on the 12th of June 1916 to accept the six-county partition of Ireland offered by Lloyd George as a solution to the Irish problem. Though it emerged later on that the nationalists in this case had believed partition was temporary, all Unionist sources spoke of it as permanent, and the Protestants of the three counties, or we might say Protestant loyalists, because of course there's going to be a debate over terminology there, internalised this as the acceptance of a permanent sundering from their homeland. Unlike the final partition, which we will examine later, this was not presented as a betrayal by their northern brethren, but rather a patriotic decision taken by the three-county Unionists for the benefit of others. Commenting on the advent of partition in 1920, the Northern Standard framed a decision taken 4 years ago as, "It was on the same lines as the action taken in 1916, when the Unionists of the three counties listened to an appeal said to come from the government and reluctantly agreed to make a great sacrifice for the sake of the empire, a sacrifice which they were afterwards assured would never again be asked from them." A pamphlet published in 1920 by the representatives to the UUC of Cavan, Monaghan and Donegal characterised this incident in similarly heroic terms. In a time of great national emergency, the three counties had placed themselves, quote, "in the hands of the other six counties, but had never abandoned the covenant." Michael Knight, a perennial MP candidate for Monaghan, speaking at an election rally in 1918, also asserted that the three counties should never again be forced to make this decision. This is, of course, an oversimplification on the part of all concerned. The delegates of 1916 never consulted with their home constituents to reach anything approaching a representative decision, and instead reached a consensus amongst themselves based on a political deal which had already passed. Their official statement at the time offered no heroic stoicism, but rather protested bitterly against the government's proposal, especially while so many three-county covenanters were all fighting a war for the same government. They do not accept the decision, but abide by it. It also ignored the attempts of Cavan delegates to have the decision revoked after they learned Lloyd George's proposals had never even been before the cabinet. Nevertheless, this was a useful fiction that allowed the three-county loyalists to stake a legitimate claim to inclusion in the northern state and existed as probably the most profound demonstration of their commitment to Ulster, that they would sacrifice themselves and not be a part of Ulster. The failure of these plans for partition then were greeted with some celebration in Cavan and Monaghan. In particular, certain parties were organised to celebrate their continuing enjoyment to the Union. These events, for all of their failure and for all of this rhetorical importance that they take on, still had planted a certain fear in the minds of three-county unionists. Speaking at a unionist meeting in Drum in 1920, James Madden declared his wish to never again see the three counties place themselves in the hands of the six counties. We see here, too, that the cries established in public rhetoric a three- and six-county dichotomy, which became well-established. Cavan, Monaghan and Donegal began to organise on a three-county basis much more frequently than they did before. The 1920 12th in Killeshandra was organised primarily on this three-county basis. In a similar manner, a meeting of the Royal Black Chapter in Clonus in 1917 presented the case of the Cavan, Monaghan and Donegal unionists under the collective three-county banner. In both of these cases, the three-county organisation was done still in very traditional Ulster terms, focusing on the sacrifice of sons and brothers in the war and of the need for Ulster Protestantism to stand together as they had against James II. In this way, Cavan and Monaghan loyalism sat aware, but relatively inactive, relatively passive, until March 1920, when the Ulster Unionist Council accepted the principle of partition contained in the Government of Ireland Act. In response to this decision, in Cavan and Monaghan was swift and outraged. At a general meeting of the three-county delegates to the UUC in Clonus, there was a unanimous agreement for them all to resign from the council. Orange Lodges in Monaghan and Cavan played on pan-Ulster fraternities, releasing statements and speeches calling on their brother Orangemen to take up the cause of resistance in the nine counties and to protect the unity of Ulster as a unit. I just heard myself say the unity of Ulster as a unit, but that's still kind of what they're aiming for. For many in the three counties, their loyalty to the Crown had brought great suffering upon them, and now this appeared pointless. We have committed no crime. We have been loyal to the flag when loyalty to the flag meant boycott, outrage and insult for us, said Robert Burns, Rector of Drum at the 12th Assembly in Clonus. In this county, it does not pay to be loyal. One would almost think we would get far better consideration from the British government if we plotted against the King and murdered His Majesty's forces behind stone walls and hedges. Michael Knight declared it as, quote, a betrayal by those who profess to be our friends. Resistance to this idea had focused heavily on the binding oath of the Covenant and employed a stricter and stricter definition of what the Covenant stood for, just as more and more Northern Unionists were attempting to define it more loosely. Even in the preceding years before this decision, something of the anxiety of the three-county community can be seen in the growing importance of Covenant Day, the anniversary of the signing of the Covenant, which was especially marked in Cavan and Monaghan by religious services, by occasional village fetes and kind of dances in Protestant halls. The Northern Standard and the Daily Mail and the Irish Mail and Weekly Telegraph covered these events quite heavily to counterbalance the otherwise quiet media focus on Cavan and Monaghan, with the Northern Standard remarking that very little has been said about the three counties during the past week, but it is enough for us to know that where the Ulster Unionists stand and that they stand where they did 5 or 6 years ago, a thoroughly united party. In response to this motion by the UUC, the three-county delegates submitted a requisition signed by 100 members of the council, forcing a special meeting on the 27th of May to reconsider the issue. The statement requesting this meeting called plaintively to their Ulster brethren not to abandon them. The Ulster people have stood together for many generations, and that confidence and reliance in each other has been the chief cause of their success and prosperity. In the lead-up to this meeting, a pamphlet was produced by the delegates to the UUC from the three counties. It opened with a copy of the direct text of the Covenant as a combination of reminder and guilt trip to sway the other delegates' mind. The only edit made to these texts was that now the word nine was bolded and put in capitals, so it read a solemn league and covenant of the nine counties of Ulster. The pamphlet argued fairly reasonably that the same demographic and political effects were true of the three counties in 1920 as they had been in 1911. Abandoning the counties now, in the face of such little change, was to invalidate the word of Ulster Unionism. The decision of the Ulster Unionist Council was criticised as rushed. The delegates had lacked time to consult with their local associations and was ill-informed, as it had been reported erroneously that Sinn Féin would hold a majority across the nine counties. The perfidy of the six-county delegates was excoriated. Their arguments to invalidate the covenant, such as that the covenant had only applied in the previous Home Rule crisis, were dismissed as idiotic and childish. And I think there's something here of an attempt to apply this dissatisfaction to a more general, or to the older divide of three and six counties, where you start seeing characteristics applied that this is very typical of Antrim men or Down men. This is what they would do, which is kind of, I think, hooking on to the two furthest points in what you might call Ulster or Ulsterism, which would be Cavan and Monaghan on one end and then Down and Antrim on the other. A six-county state was dismissed as impractically small, impractically bordered, and pointlessly politically uniform. The key argument was to dismiss the idea that the three counties should be excluded because of the nationalist majority. After all, arguing this would also lead to the exclusion of Derry City, Fermanagh, Tyrone, South Armagh, South Down, and the Falls Division of Belfast. Unfortunately for the three-county loyalists, this move was merely a delaying tactic, as the UUC again affirmed their commitment to a three-county state. The requisition was dismissed, and the three-county loyalists were assured that the decision had only been taken after much heart-searching. Presumably this was of little solace. The three-county media was swift to criticise this, saying that it is clearly obvious that to attain the full measure of selfish safety for themselves, they are prepared to jeopardise the safety of their southern friends. And I think even then, the use of the word southern is quite interesting, because you have very, very few references before this point to Cavan and Monaghan as being in any way southern. And of course, Monaghan itself is roughly is more northern than large parts of Fermanagh and parts of Down. So it's kind of, I think it's an interesting term that only starts really being used after 1920 and after partition starts coming in. Even Carson, generally held above the criticism or opprobrium of general unionist policy, was held to blame. His expressions of regret at leaving behind the three counties were roundly dismissed, the Northern Standard saying, "He need have no regrets. The regrets are ours. If the six-county leader feels any emotion, it should be that of sincere shame." However, adaptation followed resistance almost as rapidly. For some, this manifested as expressing a willingness to cooperate with the Irish Free State once established, as it was to become the legitimate state over them. In many cases, this then is expressed in very, very traditional Anglican terms, and that it is important for the Protestant people not to be tied to a single state, but whatever is the consecrated state above them. Others invested some hope in the ability of the Border Commission to rescue them from this southern domination. And if you look at the accounts to the Border Commission, there's a very interesting one from Castle Saunderson, which is right on the border and is right on the edge, and clearly was one of the places they had great hope would be included in Fermanagh, in which they say, you only need to include, you know, 3 or 4 square miles. It barely changed the makeup of either country, with the application making the concession that there was one single Catholic farmer living on the land, and if you wanted to redraw the border so his farm was on the southern side, that would be okay with Colonel Saunderson. So you have these kind of very strange, very informal representations to the Boundary Commission. And indeed, I think there's probably a separate study to be done there in the period between partition and the institution of the Boundary Commission on the different narratives, almost the planning fire, the different narratives as to what might be gotten, what might be too difficult to achieve. But that's a separate paper. For some, this transition was not so easy. A disheartened voter wrote a letter to the Northern Standard in 1921 under the pen name In the Wilderness. In this letter, he detailed his own sense of political disorientation. No longer did he feel he could vote for the Unionist Party, but he also could not vote Sinn Féin, leaving him without any way to feel represented politically. In a speech to 155 Monaghan Lodge, the chairman of the lodge, Dr. J. Campbell Hall, counselled his brethren to show, quote, "restraint, defence, not defiance, and appeal to the Orangemen and Loyalists to do nothing without consulting their leaders." The same meeting saw a speech by William Coote, who was the Tyrone MP, in which he framed the terms of accommodation with the new Irish state in very traditional Ulster manner. Loyalists must take things like true Britons, make the best of them. They had to keep a stiff upper lip and keep hammering away. While this may be very clearly a speech from the man on the right side of the border, urging those on the wrong side of it not to spoil such an advantageous settlement, This ignores a lot of the strong cultural connections between North Monaghan and South Tyrone, and the speech itself was received in very good humour by the native Monaghan audience. For most, however, adaptation was not only surprisingly easy, but surprisingly quick and surprisingly strong. The same Northern Standard had exhorted its readers that they must take on, quote, the point of view of the Southern Unionist and the Irish Unionist Alliance, instead of from the old or correct Ulster standpoint. By July 1921, this position was even more advanced, with the paper now viewing the six counties as a wholly distinct entity and speaking on behalf of Unionists of the 26 counties and Southern Unionists. A key immediate project were the attempts to organise the Unionist communities to take advantage of the new proportional representation system used in the Free State and to secure significant representation for itself. While what were traditionally cross-Ulster events, such as the 12th, now became more and more local, with the County 12th of 1920, the Clonus 12th of 1921, the Killeshandra 12th of 1922 being organised on a three-county basis. As the counties shifted into a Southern Unionist perspective, they moved to associate more amongst one another. This new Southern perspective was combined with a growing criticism of the Northern state. This criticism was a natural product of the initial anger at the UUC itself. The same delegates who had voted for partition were now seen as running the fledgling state. The very claims of those delegates to call themselves Unionists were disparaged. In a speech near Clonus, Michael Knight, who was also Grand Master of the Monaghan Orange Lodge, declared the six county Unionists had accomplished their own desire. They had sat tight in order to make for themselves positions of trust and emolument. The claims of the UUC that a nine-county Ulster state could not guarantee a Unionist majority were criticised repeatedly, especially after the comfortable Unionist majority obtained in the first Northern elections, which seemed to confirm in the eyes of the three-county Unionists that this argument had simply been a pretense by those in the North to shore up their own position. In a report on the first meeting between Craig and De Valera in May of 1921, the Northern Standard was now of the opinion that the true issue with the Government of Ireland Act was partition itself and not the establishment of a home government. If the six counties were to be induced or forced to give up the idea of a separate parliament and agree to a central assembly in Dublin, we would probably have a peace. In April of the same year, the paper complained about the expense of setting up two such parliaments and advised costs would be simpler should there be one parliament established in Dublin. So there's an irony here, obviously, in that the three-county Unionists finally find themselves on the same page as Republicans in their opposition to partition. However, at the same time, it's also worth noting that the editorial in question is an example of the paper's new policy, which actually is not unique to the Northern Standard. You find it in the Daily Mail, the Irish Mail and Weekly Telegraph. You find it in Southern Letters to the Impartial Reporter as well, this policy of referring to all six county Unionists in inverted commas. So, you know, the Unionist leader, as it were. So that is the end of what I was going to talk about really here. I think there are a few areas that looking at this could be widened out into, which I didn't really have time to look at in a half-hour paper, but which I think are quite important. So, for example, the most important comparison here to make is, I think, across the border, and especially across the border with Fermanagh and with Tyrone and with the two counties which see a Catholic Catholic majority, however small it is. I've started doing this Fermanagh comparative work now, and one of the things that comes across is that Cavan and Monaghan barely register. So while to them they may be, you know, uncontested Ulstermen, when you go across the border and when you go into other levels of Ulster Unionism, of Ulsterism, they barely get mentioned at all. You have references to how sad it is they're losing Donegal, but very few, if anything, talking about Cavan and Monaghan or even their concerns. Equally, there are other elements here which I think serve to drive three county apart from six county, which are more born of the depth of feeling of unionism in both places. The Belfast boycotts and the Belfast riots is a significant one, where the coverage and the reporting of it and the debates on it in Monaghan and in Cavan are much, much more critical of the rioters than what you see over the border, even in Fermanagh, even in Tyrone, where they kind of persist with the line that it's the Catholics' fault the entirety of the way through, whereas in Cavan and Monaghan, and especially in Cavan, you end up with a very, very critical unionism of the Belfast riots within about 2 months of their going on. Another thing which I think would be worth looking at are war losses and how, although Cavan and Monaghan have a much lower level of war losses than anywhere else, they still capitalize on them, and you still have this culture of memorialization and the establishment of memorials to the same degree of intensity that you find elsewhere. Overall, I think there's a lot of work to do, A, on examining what Ulsterism is, what it means to different counties, how it's defined and where it ends, and also whether it is continuous or whether it is a single thing or whether it's a bunch of disparate anti-nationalist groups bound together by the fact of their majority. Certainly, I think you can make the argument that Cavan, and especially Western Cavan, has very little Ulster in it, and being of Ulster is just a useful way of not ending up in the Free State, as useful as that was to them. The end.